everyone. My name is Grace Beatty, and welcome to Wicked Women, the podcast. On this podcast, I will be discussing with leading experts some of history's most infamous and maligned women. Within each episode, I do not look to excuse or dispute the wrongs committed by some of these women, but I do strive to bring a more holistic and rounded understanding of each particular woman's story. Step back in time and come on this journey with me as we discover the lives and legacies of these fascinating women. In today's episode, we will be discussing the life and legacy of Elizabeth Bathory, nicknamed the Blood Countess. Discussing Elizabeth Bathory with me today will be novelist Rebecca Johns, author of the book The Countess. Continue listening to learn more about this dark legend. It is a horror story stained with blood. A Hungarian noblewoman tortures and murders her female servants out of jealousy and a sadistic need for violence. After the grisly deed, she bathes in the blood of her victims to gain eternal youth and beauty. Some claims put her kill count in the range of 600 young women, making her possibly the most prolific female serial killer in history. Lady Gaga has played her. Bram Stoker used her as an inspiration for Count Dracula. The Grimm's brothers based the Evil Queen in Snow White after her. And countless books, movies, operas, and television shows have been dedicated to her sadistic ways. While this makes for an engaging and graphic horror story, the truth is far more elusive. In recent years, scholars and authors have begun to question the legitimacy of these legends surrounding Elizabeth Bathory, an attempt to find the real woman underneath. Elizabeth Bathory was born into an influential and wealthy Hungarian noble family in 1560. However, much of Elizabeth's early life has been overshadowed by her legendary murderous persona. Here is author Rebecca Johns on what we do know about Elizabeth's upbringing and the world that she lived in.
Well, there's not a lot of research out there about her. So she was the daughter of two different wealthy families, grew up in the eastern part of Hungary. Hungary at that time was under Ottoman rule. It had been conquered by Suleiman the Magnificent, the famous Ottoman ruler, and divided. The country was divided. And there were people in Hungary who were kind of split between whether they wanted to be independent, whether they wanted to be part of the Habsburg Empire, the old Holy Roman Empire. So there were a lot of political machinations going on behind the scenes. And the Palatine of Hungary, kind of the equivalent of the prime minister, was a friend of the family, and she was quite close with him for a while. She got married as a child, an arranged marriage with Ferenc Nadasdy. I probably bungled that a little bit because, again, I don't speak Hungarian. I did get help with the pronunciations from somebody who did speak Hungarian. To Americanize the name, you'd have to call him Francis. That's probably the closest to anglicize the name. But the two of them did not spend much time together at the beginning of their relationship, and it didn't seem to be a terribly warm relationship, apparently, according to legend, until Elizabeth showed some interest in torture, which was her husband's specialty. He was a bit brutal on the battlefield, and apparently he schooled her in some of those techniques. There are also rumors, also completely unsubstantiated, but I decided to run with them anyway, that she bore an illegitimate child before her marriage. I just thought that was fun for her to have her own kind of little romance. That was, since she was in an arranged marriage, and that would have been a lot. to take at the time. I can't. I mean, I do think women were expected to do that, but I don't think I would have gone to the yoke quite so easily. So I liked to let her have her own little tiny bit of rebellion. It doesn't go well in the novel. And then, she has several good years with her husband before he dies rather unexpectedly. And then for the 10 years after his death, she was a wealthy widow of means and completely in control of a very large estate. She was lending money to the crown, and there's some thoughts among some historians that the demonization of her began as a way for him to get out of having to pay her back.
After her husband's death in 1604, rumors of Elizabeth's heavy-handed punishments towards female servants spread across Hungary. According to some historians, her torturous ways were so well known that fathers refused to allow their daughters into Elizabeth's home. In 1610, an official investigation was launched by King Matthias II to look into rumors of Elizabeth's abuse and murder of young girls. The investigation included 300 witnesses that claimed she beat, burned, and mutilated as many as 80 servants between the ages of 10 to 14. After Elizabeth's death, this estimate climbed as high as 800 young girls and incorporated the instance of her bathing in the blood of her victims to remain young. While the extent of torture and murder done at Elizabeth's hand can never fully be known, Rebecca states,
I think there's good evidence to suggest that probably she did get a little bit too enthusiastic in some of her punishments, and that they maybe did lead to the deaths of 30 to 35 women and girls, which is not an insignificant number by any means. I think we always have to take the overly inflated numbers of like 600, 650. That's kind of the upper limit. I heard somebody say 800 one time. I don't know where that number came from. But it's fun to have these like ridiculous legends, but the real story is a little bit less grandiose, a little more complicated, more complex, and more human.
In the end, Elizabeth was never convicted of any crime, but she remained under house arrest and her name was ruined. For Rebecca, what is most fascinating but unknown is Elizabeth's view of herself under these circumstances. While the number of casualties and types of torture have been exaggerated over centuries, the reality is she did harm and kill people. Did she view herself as guilty or as a victim? For Rebecca, that is the true mystery.
I think it's very rare that anyone, male or female or other, who commits terrible crimes views themselves as evil and wrong. They usually feel like they have some kind of justification for doing it. It's not a good justification, but I think if you speak to most of them, they will call themselves the victim. I think that's a both very natural and very horrifying way to view it, is that they don't see anything wrong. And I think that was true in her case too. I think she felt like she had total authority to do what she wanted with her servants. And if her servants misbehaved, she had the right to discipline them however she wanted. And her disciplines, apparently, from the research I did, got very creative. Who she was as a person and how she would have justified her actions to herself. How she would have told the story to herself about who she was and how she ended up where she did. And I think all of that was part of that story. The politics of the time, the fact that she was a woman, and if she was accused, she didn't have a lot of recourse. They had a trial in which her servants were tortured into making confessions against her. So, you can't trust that kind of eyewitness material. But anyway, that was kind of how I approached it. It's a very different way than other people who've written about her have written, and that was deliberate. I really wanted her to be able to say what happened in her own words. If I couldn't write in the first person, I didn't want to do it. So that was very important to me.
In the wake of the trial, Elizabeth wrote her will, bestowing all of her wealth and lands to her children, many of which she had not seen in years. She died still under house arrest in 1614. In the centuries after her death, Elizabeth Bathory, or the Blood Countess, became a well-known ghost story and cautionary tale of what can result from a woman's vanity. Here is Rebecca.
It's not really until 100 years later that this legend started, and then it really took off in the 19th century. There's an idea that perhaps she was the inspiration for the Wicked Queen in Snow White. So the epigraph of my novel is from the Grimm's fairy tale about Snow White. People think that this idea of this wicked queen killing the young beautiful girls for her vanity, for her jealousy, of the inspiration. It's certainly, you know, that part of the world where the Grimm brothers were going to gather their material when they were getting their books of fairy tales, and that the time period is about right. It becomes a cautionary tale against women's vanity. You know, the whole idea of she was bathing in blood and putting it on her skin to make herself look young and beautiful. It's all about, you know, kind of warning against vanity in women. You know, and I'm not saying there wasn't a touch of that in there. I mean, not the bathing in blood, obviously, because that did not happen. But the idea that the younger women presented a threat to her. In the novel, some of the maids that she tortures are bragging that they're sleeping with her husband. So, you know, there could be some of that in the story too, but not because she wants to bathe in their blood and look young and beautiful. It's because she's trying to hold on to her position in the house, which is more important necessarily than her relationship with her husband. It's really about her maintaining her place as the lady of the house. One of my, I teach Frankenstein and in some of my science fiction and literature and writing classes. And sometimes I like to tell people the story of Mary Shelley and Percy Bysshe Shelley and Lord Byron and John Polidori hanging out in Geneva in the summer of 1816. It's so gloomy. And they're reading from a book of German ghost stories to each other. And I need to look it up one of these days. This is making me remember. I need to actually get my hands on a copy of this book if such a thing exists anymore. But that's the kind of, the Bathory story is the kind of thing that would have appeared in that book. So, and that is, you know, 1816. So you say it's about 100 years after the first legends of her appeared. So we're talking about 200 years on. That's plenty of time for a person like her to have morphed into more than a cautionary tale, you know, into, as people retell the story and it becomes like an oral history and it's retold, it gets embellished. People add their own little touches and flourishes. And so 35 women becomes 100, becomes 300, becomes 600. Torture becomes bathing in blood. You know, that I think that there it's definitely meant to spook you and scare you and horrify. But there is that kernel still, I think, of a cautionary tale kind of built inside of it, which is, look at what happens when women are vain and women care too much about their looks, etc. And, you know, part of my whole interest in the story was recapturing and taking her back down to the human level, out of this kind of crazy supernatural over the top persona, back to the very flawed person that I imagine her to be. And of course, you know, I did a lot of research. I did as much research as I could. And to be honest, I changed very little. When I look at the timeline of the story, I think I moved her husband's death back by a couple of years just to kind of move things along a little bit faster. But that's the only change I made from the whole history of her life.
As George Orwell once stated, myths which are believed in tend to become true. For Elizabeth Bathory, this is readily apparent. As I shared with friends and coworkers my plan to make an episode about Elizabeth, people would often say, "Oh, is that the woman who bathed in her victim's blood?" Or, "She inspired Dracula, you know," and many variations on the same. As Rebecca stated, the myth of Elizabeth Bathory easily eclipsed any reality that may have remained.
That she was the most prolific female serial killer in history. I mean, she might be, but because the historical record on this is not at all accurate, Again, it was like 100 years later. The people are like, we discovered her diary, and there were 650 names in there. And there's nothing in there that says those are the people she killed. She was also meant to be a wise woman and a healer. Those, could be names of women that who had come to her for healthcare reasons. You know, as a learned person who was responsible for the people in her lands, her properties. They would have come to her. Also, I'm not sure that diary is a real thing that exists. I'm not sure that anyone has actually seen it. So I think everything that we know about her through pop culture, you have to take with a huge grain of salt. Things like the American Horror Story Countess, when Lady Gaga portrayed a version of her on screen. Like all of that stuff is totally fun, and I get it. But like the real life person was nothing like that. You know, even Vlad Tepes, who's the inspiration for Dracula, was a warrior. He killed people in battle, and you know, he did the way he killed people was pretty heinous. I won't go into it here, but it was pretty horrible. Not the way you would want to go. But you know, lots of people did terrible things in battle. That doesn't make him a vampire, but it is kind of fun to turn these historical figures into larger than life kind of supernatural beings. But you know, the real story is usually a lot less crazy. Well, I think people like their stories to have clear messages. They didn't like that someone could get away with murder and what it maybe it said about the world that someone was able to get away with it. So I think people do like their stories. They like good people to be rewarded and bad people to be punished. Things that end up in the gray area are not as interesting, or at least they weren't. I think that actually we've had a bit of a resurgence in interest in more complicated characters. I think of things like Walter White in Breaking Bad, who starts off very sympathetically and then that sympathy is stripped away. You know, day by day by day, when you're watching that show, and or a Tony Soprano, you know, the mobster who's going for therapy. It's a funny premise, but you can't forget that he's, you know, in addition to being a human being with mental health issues, he's also a murderer and a mobster responsible for a lot of crime and destruction. And so I think there's maybe we're moving away from it again. But for a while there, we were very much more interested in people who kind of lived in the gray areas a little bit.
For Rebecca, when her publisher brought forward the idea of writing a fictional portrayal of Elizabeth Bathory, she felt that it would provide an opportunity to bring humanity to the gory legend, but also to provide nuance by making Elizabeth an unreliable narrator. She is telling her own story, allowing readers to see the experience through her own very personal point of view. Here is Rebecca.
The fact that she was an educated woman of her time, that she was constantly underestimated by people in power and the men around her, and even her own husband at times, who was more famous than she was for a long time, it kind of, I don't want to say tugged at the heartstrings, because never, never at any point was she tugging at my heartstrings. But the thought of the humanity of her, you know, kind of taking her, recapturing her story from this kind of cartoonish, evil, over the top figure that's now been so parodied in popular media that she's almost unrecognizable, and bringing her back to a human scale where, you know, she didn't murder 600 girls and she didn't bathe in blood. Like the two things that everybody thinks they know about her turned out not to be true. So, you know, I would not say at any point that she was a good person and that we should try to be like her, but she's not this like otherworldly demon. She was a very flawed human being, but I'm not sure that her behavior was all that different than other women of her station and time. You know, the other wealthy people of that time, of that world, were allowed to have a very free hand with the people who lived under them. And, you know, there's also something I feel like that speaks to our modern lives, that we are still, I think, in believing some of the things that were common in the time period. The idea that if you're wealthy, you're blessed. If you're wealthy, you deserve it. And, you know, that you then can act with impunity. I think that's a very insidious idea that the culture is still dealing with. And so I was really interested in exploring her story. Well, fiction's best use, I think, is allowing us to experience somebody else's life. It's like you get to slip them on for a little while and walk around in their head. It's funny because, I really like Stephen King's memoir on writing, and he calls writing a form of telepathy, where you're beaming an image from your head into the mind of a reader across space and across time. Patricia Highsmith is dead, and yet I'm reading her book, and I'm looking at the world through her eyes while I'm reading it. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, it's as immersive as virtual reality, maybe more so, because you have to conjure up the images out of your own brain, your own experiences, rather than relying on somebody else's. So it's more immersive than a movie. It's more immersive than a TV show or a video game, but also more uncomfortable. And so I think, you know, for example, I checked out that book, You, that stalker story that's written in the second person, where the stalker is addressing the victim of his stalkering through the whole thing. It's very uncomfortable to be in his head. It's really kind of painful because you just find him so abhorrent. A book makes you kind of take on that person's brain, that person's experience. Someone is telling you the story, and so you're living inside that person's head. Even if it's just the author, or even an omniscient narrator, it's usually the author's voice that you're hearing. They're telling you the story. Maybe they're not using the first person I, but they're still, it's their voice. They're telling it to you. And so you're living in their head for a little bit. And that requires acts of empathy that I think as a culture we desperately need, you know, to be able to really put yourself in someone else's shoes. And I tell my students that all the time, my graduate writing students, the writer's job is to put this character on and walk around in their head and see the world through their perspective. And the more you can do that, the better the story's going to be.
In the end, Elizabeth Bathory may never and probably should never be seen as a person to aspire to, but her story can provide a different and very meaningful message.
I think I would like for people to not always believe the first thing they hear. You know, just because a legend is cool and over the top and sounds outrageous and crazy, but you do your own research, you know? Like, if you're interested in these women, like, look into them. What were they really like? What was their time period really like? Who are they really? And there's a lot of interesting scholarship, I think, going on with new eyes. You know, people are kind of waking up to the idea that some of the stories that are passed down to us from history are biased in one way or another. And so it's worth kind of digging into things yourself and finding out what the truth is or might have been, you know, to get closer to it if you want to. But at the very least, to approach received wisdom with some skepticism.